This is what should be done by one who's skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
We'll start the meditation today. So, just get ourselves in a comfortable position. And as I give a guided meditation, these are just the preliminaries. So if we have our own preliminaries, if we have our own means of meditation, then, you know, the words just become background noise. So when we're meditating, we don't need to be reacting. We just start by taking a comfortable but upright position. And we just see that the body is in a good position, a posture that we're able to hold for the meditation. We try and keep the body relatively still. And even if pain arises, we see if we don't have to react to the pain. We don't have to make a big story about it. But sometimes we can just continue with our meditation and it just vanishes on its own. So we can just start by scanning through the body. The tips of the hair of the head down towards the soles of the feet. Just becoming aware of the posture, of any aches and pains, and just accepting the body as it is. As the body begins to relax, the mind settles down. From the soles of the feet back up towards the tips of the hair of the head. relaxing the whole body inside out. From the bone marrow to the skin. And once the body is settled down, you can also relax the eyes. As the eyes get further relaxed, the agitation and anxiety begins to settle down. Nowhere we need to go, nothing we need to think about. It's just the whole world is to vanish. Just put it all down. And there we're going to have to die, and we've got to let go then. We may as well let go now. Whatever problems, whatever thoughts, desires, irritations, just let it all go. Body relaxed, the eyes relaxed. Now we look at our mind, our heart, our mental experience, whatever you want to call it. How is our mind state? Just allow our mind state to settle down. Doesn't need to go out into the world, into stories, proliferations, the sense doors. The mind come into the present, the mind seeing the mind. Once we've established ourselves with the preliminaries, and then the time to bring up our meditation object, our preferred theme. I'll give a guide of meditation for the first part with the breath for those who wish. Might like to watch the breath at the tip of the nose, at the upper lip, or to use the mantra Buddha, which means awake, or the awakened one. Buddha, the in-breath. Do, the out-breath. Or just the sensations of the breath coming in. The upper lip, or at the nostrils. Aware of an in-breath coming in. It's the present moment. Out breath going out. It's the present moment. Now just let everything else go like passing clouds. We don't attach to the clouds. We don't attach to the weather. We just let it all pass by. So anything that arises, we let it go. And gently, patiently come back to our meditation object. Just not a problem. Sense of uprightness. And relaxation. Content with few desires, few wants. Just keen awareness with the in-breath. Keen awareness. awareness with the out-breath. Keeping our upright posture, sense of inner alertness, begin to relax the breath, relax the formations of the in-breath, relax the formations of the out-breath, sense of quietness and ease. Just gently picking up and sustaining our chosen means. May even be a sense of delight just to be secluded with our meditation object, not a care in the world. A delightful ease. be silent for the next 15 minutes, just to our rest, to have the apprentice mind, no concerns. as we come towards the end of the meditation, just come out in our own time. And just see the result of half an hour of meditation. We can see the causes and effects. Find out what preliminaries work, what things work for us, and what things don't work. Maybe take this peace and gentleness and patience into our lives. In time, we may end the meditation. There's a simile of the acrobat. I can't remember exactly. So in Buddhism we have four main books, which are like the teachings of the Buddha. I haven't even read them all. Because the idea is we just take a bit and practice. So over the years I just, you know, take one or two teachings and then really practice them. But I remember the simile of the acrobat. Can't remember if it's one of the Buddha's pastimes. Anyway, there's a senior acrobat and maybe an apprentice acrobat. The senior acrobat, you know, tightrope up in the air, and he says, okay, I look after you and you look after me, and then, you know, we'll both be good. And then the apprentice acrobat says, no, I look after myself and you look after yourself, and then we can, you know, by doing so, we can protect each other. Because if you're busy thinking about the other person when you're up there, what's going to happen? You're going to fall. And so this is like our practice. Our mind tricks us into thinking that when we go do this, when we go help other people, when we do these things, you know, then we're helping ourselves. But actually, if we don't look after our own mind, if we don't help ourselves, then we can't really help other people. And so meditation is... or generosity, or the precepts, these things are important because they lead to a peaceful mind. Because when we have a peaceful mind, you know, then our mind is like the kettle's ready to boil. So you have the kettle ready to boil and you don't have to start up from cold all the time. And so this is like our practice. If we're constantly, every day, we're vigilant, and we make sure we're developing a peaceful mind, make sure we're learning to be mindful, make sure we're developing our meditation object, and when difficult things happen, we're ready for it. We can think, but the problem is we don't prepare our mind for that. Like, we know these things, but we never think about them. And because we don't think about them, then when some disaster happens, somebody dies, you find a dead person, whatever it is, something we're not used to, then, you know, our mind turns into a turbulent storm. But actually, you know, these are all things like a part of life. These are the things that happen to all of us. And in Buddhism, the word is dukkha, which is suffering. So suffering is pain, lamentation, despair, grief, all of those things. And right down in Buddhism, there are realms of existence. And so there is actually a hell realm. So people, if you do all your bad actions in a row, then beings actually for a time end up in a really bad state. And that's called dukkati, so like place of suffering. But we don't need to look that far away though. I mean, just look at the animal realm. Look how much suffering it is for them. They're constant, like the kangaroos, you know, they're out in the weather, day and night, they're trying to feed. Every time they've had one joey, they've got another one. You know, so it's like life is suffering. And so you know, when we have suffering, we the first thing we want to do is get rid of it. But actually, in Buddhism, the first noble truth is knowledge of suffering. The suffering is. Because no matter how much happiness we have, like let's say you were, like a king and you had 500 sets of clothes and 500 meals to choose from, you can still only eat one meal, you can only wear one set of clothes. So even though you have all those things, I mean, what's it really worth? You know? And so, and then that happiness, so when we give in Buddhism, is called it's karma vipaka. So karma is the action and vipaka is the result. And so, you know, when we do good things, it makes us feel good. But also there's like a law of karma where because those good things, then depending on the level of, like when we're giving, we should give with a mind intent on giving. And when receiving, you should give with a mind intent on receiving. And then there's the highest merit, the highest level of karma from that interaction. And the reason the Buddha set up the Sangha, so like the ordained Sangha, like the monks and the nuns, is that we're dependent on the gifts of others. So people who give to us, they get to benefit from our practice. So, you know, the thongs and the robes and the food that we eat, all these things are given to us. So people who are just living normal lives and come to the temple, we have like an offering here and with the other temples every day, people come and they offer food. So then that's a way of learning to be generous. And then if you reflect on that later, you're like, well, that person, you know, they got that food from me. So their meditation, or even if they're a scallywag monk, you're like, well, maybe one day they'll be a good monk, you know. They're just doing all these other things at the moment. So then you don't worry about that. But one day maybe, you know, you give a meal to somebody who's a really good practitioner. And all the meditation, all the experiences they have, you know, they benefit from that. And so this is why the Buddha usually, when he was teaching the gradual training to the lay community, he would teach in a gradual way. And so you have to look at what is the benefit of renouncing the sense pleasures. So obviously, if you're going to a temple and you're giving up one of your days or one of your weekends. And then, you know, you had to cook food or buy food and then go to the temple. So there's all these sacrifices occurring. And then the same, and then when you actually give, then you get the results of that. And so in one day, if you actually gave to somebody, like I remember there was a great Thai monk who came to Australia once, and he said to the layperson who offered him the glass of water, he said, well, in a future life, you'll never go without water now. You know, because like in Buddhism, there's four stages of enlightenment. If somebody's at one of the higher stages, the gift to a being like that, it might be worth 10,000 gifts to somebody of the lower phases. But the Buddha didn't want us to think like this, like you just give freely. But the idea is that there is cause and effect. There is karma, vipaka. And so when we start to investigate this, we have to convince our minds, we have to have a conversation in our minds that, you know, maybe we do one less holiday in a year, you know, and try and live within our means. And because when we simplify our lives and then we have, you know, because the worldly aims, they're just leading towards pleasure. They're just leading to better houses and keeping up with the Joneses. And that only gets you so far, you know. But what is it at the end of your life, when you look back at your life, what is the things that are going to bring happiness in your heart? Or at the moment you die, if you've been generous, you know, if you've gone out of your way to help homeless people and monks and nuns, if you've helped sick family members, you know, all these things, these are things that beautify the heart. And, you know, it's just like, and also learning to be frugal. Like my robe at the moment, I usually like to wear patch robes. So my robes last years, and my bed sheet and my jumper, and you know, I use them for everything. And try and one of my thongs that I had, you know, I got to the point where they had a hole in them. I wore them, so the shopkeeper was quite impressed. So I think I hadn't seen those thongs ever worn so thin before. So the point is, you can make use of things. You know, you don't have to be in a hurry to always get the best of everything. And because what is it that really makes us happy? It's a peaceful mind. So more possessions aren't necessarily the answer. And Ajahn Tui, a great Thai Ajahn, when he came to Australia, he learned a few lines of English. And one of the lines that he said is, convenient but troublesome. So whenever your mind's trying to tell you something, just say convenient but troublesome. And how true that is. And so the idea is that sometimes it is troublesome first. And we have to put up with a bit of difficulty. We have to put up with a bit of suffering. We've got to learn to be more frugal. We've got to learn not to always follow our desires and be somebody who sees the benefit of renunciation. And it's just like teaching a child that they shouldn't eat candy for dinner, you know. They might want to eat candy for dinner, but it's not going to do them any good in the long run. And this is like our minds. And just because our minds want to do these things, they want to have these desires, they want to follow after all this worldly stuff, doesn't mean that that's what we should do with all of our time. Is that stuff really going to nurture our minds? And, you know, so it's like television and books and newspapers and entertainment. I mean, it's fine to have these things, but when they fill our lives and that's where people are getting their happiness from, you know, you can see why everybody gets so stressed out when there's, you know, some adversity occurs in the world. But, you know, there's always going to be wars and death and famine and disease and droughts. And one day all the water on the earth will dry up and that'll be real suffering. And so, but the point is that suffering is a cycle. But if we can use our adversities to say, yes, you know, suffering is real. Right? This is proof. I'm suffering. I have lamentation. I have depression. I have anxiety. I have this. Okay, well, what's the path to overcoming this? What's the path to developing a mind that can become peaceful at any time, that can weigh things up and see that it's not as important that we're making it out to be? Because, you know, when the Buddha taught lay people, he wanted them to get to the point that when you die, you let go and move on. Like you don't even worry about your possessions or your family or anybody, because that life's done with. You just accept whatever results of karma you have and you move on to your next life. And so that's a pretty high call. But that's the level that, you know, he was wanting lay people to practice to. And obviously it's like Mahanama and Anapanapindika. And so there's some great kind of lay disciples in this, you know, teachings to these people. But what is it all about? It's about basically attachment. It's about clinging. So the reason we suffer is because we cling to me and mine, to us and them, and we create all these stories about it. But at the moment, is the past here with us now? Can anybody bring the past into this room? Can anybody bring the future into this room? No. And so, I mean, the past did exist at that time, and the future will exist at that time, but at the moment, only the present exists. So, you know, time machines, we've never yet seen anybody build a time machine. I don't think that they work. But, you know, science fiction is always going to have these ideas. But the idea is, in the present, if we learn to be mindful and present, then we can solve our suffering right here. Because our suffering is arising out of our attachment. So we're attaching to, you know, our possessions. It's like counting, you know, counting your neighbor's cows in the paddock back in the day, you know. Oh, look how many cows I've got. I've only got two cows. And then you suffer. You know, so first of all, people should try and live within their means, you know. And then whatever you decide, even if you have debts and things, live in a way where you're not going to get stressed by it. Because If you're going to live in stress, what's the point of that? You know? So the first thing is to get your life in order, but then don't just live for yourself. So you live so you know how to save for a rainy day, you know how to help your family, and you also have enough to be generous as well. Because when we're generous, it makes us feel happy. You know, if you don't want to give to monks and nuns and monasteries, then, you know, like a soup kitchen or some homeless people or helping out in the community in some way. So there's many ways we can help. And then by giving up of our own time, or even just, you know, give up one holiday or give up one week's wage or something and give that money to somebody who really needs it. You know, because do we really need that next thing that our desire says we need? Or can we actually do without it? And then, but you have to do what Ajahn Chah said, it's like the big apple and the small apple. You know, if you have a big apple and a small apple and you're like, oh yeah, I'll give the big apple to my friend. And when the moment comes, you give them the small apple and you have the big apple. So what you got to do is you got to convince your mind, you got to give the big apple even if it hurts. And then afterwards, you can teach yourself that it was a good thing, because then you'll be happy that you gave yourself a friend a big apple. But it's easier said than done. And so it just depends. Like, some people are more generous. Like, I was fortunate. I came in this life very generous. But my more problem was in other areas. So you just have to see where your mind is at. But the good thing about generosity, or in other words, is liberality. Probably a closer translation, which means like freely giving. So this is the quality of mind. Because when we're freely giving, we're not being miserly. You know, it doesn't mean we give beyond our means. We don't give until, you know, we're holding a poncho over our heads. But we give in a balanced way. I think there is a teaching of the Buddha where you balance your money into four different streams. And so to cover the various areas of his life that he suggested. So the idea is that, you know what you're doing, become skillful in those things, because obviously to be in the world you need money. But eventually at the higher stages of practice, you know, people can actually live in the world without money. So there was an anagami at the time of the previous Buddha. He couldn't become a monk because both his parents were blind. But he had already attained to the stage just below enlightenment called Anagami, which means after that, when you die, you're reborn in a place called the Pure Abodes without a body. And but the Buddha, even though he was an Anagami, even though he was so attained with meditation, you know, he still knew about giving. So he still went about his way giving. So the Buddha of that time, he was considered his number one disciple, because he knew he could go there. One day the Buddha, Kassapa, went there and started taking the thatches off the roof without even asking him, because he knew. You know, he was such a good disciple that he didn't even have to ask. He could just go start taking down some of his roof and use it on his own little hut. And once he went there and, you know, had the food, just the blind parents were there and his friend wasn't there. This man wasn't there, but he just took the food anyway because his trust was so deep. And this man was just a potter. And all he lived by was putting out pots each day, making little pots. And then he had a sign there saying, just leave food and take what you want. But you're welcome to leave food. So he didn't ever ask for money. He didn't even disturb soil. So he used to wait for the clay to wash up on the sides of the riverbanks. So just to show you that there is possibility of people simplifying their lives. But on the other side of it, Anapanapindika, he was very rich. And he donated the Anapanapindika Park. And then he furnished it. So I think he spent 2/3 of his wealth just on building a monastery that the Buddha spent much of his life in. So there's nothing wrong with being wealthy, but how many wealthy people are actually using their wealth in a wise way? You know? So it just depends on, you know, our aims in life. But the point is, when we give, we can reflect on that. So if we just give and then we go, oh, I shouldn't have given that. Now I don't have that. Then that's a bad way of giving. But if you know, you bring it up on a day where, you know, you're having a bad day, or even just reflection on peace. Like, if we don't recall the peace, like, say in a day or two, if you've got a busy mind, you just look at the mind, well, you know, why don't I have any peace right now? And then you go, okay, well, I'll go do a meditation. And then if you can't get into the meditation, you can recall the peace of your last meditation. Now, what was it like? Now, what did I do? How did I do it? And then it's like walking through the snow. You know, if every day you just walked in through the snow in a different direction, it would be very difficult. But what you do is you make a path. And every day you walk along that path, eventually, you know, it's easy to walk through the snow. And so the problem is our main path and our mind are all going in the wrong directions. You know, our paths just say, okay, attach to what is happy, be sad when anything bad ever happens, and be ignorant of everything else. And so this is how our mind is wired. So we need to say, well, what is the benefit of renouncing of the senses? You know, even though it's difficult, now I will do my meditation every day, an hour a day, or whatever we've chosen to do. And then we make that a standard, that even if it's difficult, even if 8 meditations, we feel like we're holding under the seat. Now we might have 2 meditations of peace. And then over time, it gets better and better. As we, you know, if we can't work it out on our own, we go to a teacher and we find out, you know, why it's not working for us. And then eventually, you get to the point where you can develop the mindfulness and the peace throughout the day. Because when we can cultivate it through the day, then even if, you know, we get a phone call, somebody died, or, you know, this happened or that happened, or the end of the world's coming, you don't have to be upset. I mean, how many times have they predicted the end of the world? And so if we always got upset at external things, how are we going to have a peaceful mind? You know? And, you know, it's difficult to develop a mind that can let go. And so there's some other practices. So as well as doing the meditation, I've actually done some other meditation objects, like learning to have an even mind, where you are just bringing the mind back to the central position. So when you see it go out liking, bring it back. When you see it going out disliking, bring it back. And so by bringing the mind into a more balanced place, because it's like upeka, which is equanimity. And equanimity is quite a refined state, and it's developed both through the meditation at the higher stages, but it's also developed through wisdom. And when we have equanimity, we have mindfulness, because we're not getting, it's like if we just always react to our sense objects, you know. First there's the dog barking, and then there's a chainsaw, and then there's a car going past. If that's all you're reacting to in your meditation, well, you know, we're not really meditating. And so you've got to come back from that and restrain the senses. But how do you restrain the senses? Well, you give up this liking process of liking and disliking. And basically it's arising, in Buddhism we have a thing called the 5 khandhas. So we have form, feeling, the labels of what we perceive, volition, and cognition. And so these are our 5 parts of our being. And so this is what's actually here in the present, arising and passing away. So when we eat, when we drink, when we breathe, our form is changing. You know, the wind blows, we have external form, there's internal form. But we're attaching to this form as ourself. So, you know, if we lose an arm, we're going to go, oh no, that's my arm. But, I mean, do you own those elements? Or they're just some food that you ate once, which is now your arm? You know, and so it's like, it's because we don't see things in line with reality that when bad things happen, we attach to how we perceived our body to be, or we want to change somebody else's mind, or we want somebody else to be different. But these five groups, this is what we cling to. So we cling to, you know, form that we like, we're averse to form that we don't like. In feeling, there's three kinds of feelings. There's happiness and suffering, and neither happiness nor suffering. So all feelings can be grouped into that. So usually we attach to happiness, we're averse to suffering, and we're indifferent and ignorant to everything in between. So mindfulness is basically where whatever feeling arises, we just see it like a bubble that appears from a raindrop on the water, on a river. It rises for a time and then it ceases. So the greatest happiness of meditation you ever had arises for a time and then it ceases. A moment of peace that you have. Say you've done 10 meditations and you finally had some peace. And it was really difficult, all the other 9 meditations. But that peace will arise and then it will cease. And so we need to look. And then the labels, that's another way. So, you know, this is a human, that is a cat, this is a dog. Whenever we see something and we label it, a feeling is attached to it. And then the three types of volition. We have volition of mind. So that's our thoughts. It's, believe it or not, that's within our control. And then volition of speech. And then volition of the body. And so one good thing about meditation, at that time, we're limiting all these things. And that, because we're limiting them, we're giving us a chance to use them in a proper way. And then cognition, well, that's just knowing. But even the cognition is arising and passing away. So what we take to be ourselves is just like a stream. It's a, like a point in the stream. If you look at a river, the river's moving along. Yet the point's, you know, still water there. And so this is like our body, like our mind. It's something that's constantly changing. But it's our delusion that says, you know, this is me. You know, I was that 6-year-old child. I'm that 20-year-old person. I'm this person now. That person is that. This person is this. So we're limiting everything. And convention is useful, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to get along with anything in the world. We wouldn't be able to, hey, you over there, you know, your names are useful. You know, so we need these things. But ultimately, they're causing us suffering because we're attaching to them as real. You know, it's like a convention, conventional reality. So it has a use, you know. Without it, we wouldn't be able to get along with each other. But when we attach to these things, then we make stories out of them, and then suddenly the past and the future arise. But so in Buddhism, we're taught to live every day as if it's our last. So if we're living if this day is our last, then, you know, we don't revive the past and don't build your hopes upon the future. You know, leave the past behind and don't worry about the future. And instead, we see the things that are arising right now. You know, if we have a bad mind state, okay, just know, now is a bad mind state arising. Maybe it's not a good time for me go to talk to other people, you know. I'll just go for a walk, I'll do something wholesome, you know. And so we limit our suffering to just being aware of what's arising, you know. But then because we start to know the causes for peace, if we continue putting those causes in, then, you know, how many, we've got a million moments in a day. So to begin with, maybe we only use, you know, 100 of them in a day. We remember to come back and be mindful, you know, to let go, to be peaceful. But still, that's 100 moments that we didn't have otherwise. And then with as those moments build, then we start to see the benefit of being mindful. And then same with our meditation, it begins to yield results. And but yeah, don't be like there's these monkeys once who were asked in a Buddhist fable. These monkeys were asked by a king's royal gardener to look after his plants. So the monkey king and all the monkeys are like, okay, we'll water the plants while the gardener's away. And then after the gardener's gone, they start pulling up all the plants from the roots and measuring them to see how much water they need, and then putting them back in the ground and watering them. So, meaning that, you know, we're just going to be somebody who puts the causes in with our meditation. We don't want quick results, but we know what we're doing, you know. So that's why in Buddhism there is a set method we follow, and then it's just a matter of doing the work and not being in a hurry and having an apprentice mind. But the suffering is really arising at the attachment. So we attach to form, we attach to feeling, we attach. So we either want these things or we don't want them. We attach to the labels. But I mean, like a piece of meat. You put a piece of meat out in the sun, and soon it's a piece of rotten meat. And in a month, it's not even there anymore. So labels change, you know. So what we call it, it's just a name. It's not actually that name. It's actually a bunch of elements, you know, that have arisen due to causes, and when those causes cease, that thing will cease. So the names are useful, but they're not reality. And so for us to understand this, so that's why we do the meditation, that's why we do the mindfulness. But eventually, because we see the danger of suffering, we don't get involved with those things in the same way. So then we don't get burnt by suffering. Like if you know there's a burning ball of lava metal over there, you know, whether you touch it on the top or you touch it on the side or you touch it on the bottom or you touch it on the back, still going to burn you. Or you swallow it whole, still going to burn you. And so that's the idea, that when we suffer in life, we just have to see, okay, I'm suffering. And this was the cause, you know, this attachment was here. And because, you know, I didn't have the mindfulness, I didn't have the meditation, I didn't have the peace, and it led to this mind state. And because of that, suffering is still continuing. But even the bad mental states, you know, they arise and eventually they pass. But the important thing is to learn from suffering. In Buddhism, you know, we believe in past lives, and I think Ajahn Tate said, you know, past lives are to be counted in their millions. So people who know about these things say things like that, and that's interesting, because then if you look at our suffering in one life, now that's enough. But think about a million lives, meaning like when are we going to start getting at the root of these problems, because otherwise they're going to occur again and again and again. And so this just comes back to the suffering is to be known, which is the first of the Four Noble Truths. And really, until somebody sees suffering, until somebody really, you know, sees how difficult life can be, then it's really hard to practice. So we use the suffering in our life as a leverage, really, to get us to practice. Because we go, if I don't suffer, and then my life falls apart, and these things happen, there's going to be real suffering. Or, you know, old age, look at somebody who's getting closer to death, and they're not prepared for it, and they haven't developed good qualities, and it's really suffering for them. So that's the talk on suffering. So we'll finish with the finish with the chant. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of Death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile,
May all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease and all harmful states of mind until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble Lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I'll finish with a little chant. Yata varivaha pura paripuranti sagarang evang eva itodinang petanang upakapati itchitang patitang tunghang kipameva samichatu sepeparantu sangapa chando panaraso yata manijoti raso yata Vityo vivajantu sabaroko vinasatu mate pavantvan tarayo sukiti kayuko pava apiva nanasili sanichang vuta pachayino chataro dhamma vadanti Ayuvano Sukhang Balam. Okay, thank you for coming.
Thank you.